supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
First, it was regional rail trains. Now, Philadelphia's Market Frankford L cars are found to have flaws. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. SEPTA pulled 58 of the cars out of service over the weekend after cracks were found in their motor vents. SEPTA says it's working to clarify how many cars have the problem and then fix them. WHYY's Jim Saxon reports that cracked vents aren't all that dangerous, but they appear to have caused breaks in some critical support beams.
It was just a routine inspection that led SEPTA to sideline one quarter of its Market Frankford fleet. At first, nothing seemed wrong with car 1091. But as he briefed reporters, SEPTA General Manager Jeff Knuppel said problems hid just underneath the surface.
On Friday night, a SEPTA mechanic was performing scheduled vehicle overhaul work at our 69th Street shop. After removing a section of the car floor, he astutely noticed a crack in a main load-carrying member called a car body bolster.
That part, the car body bolster, is a critical support beam running the width of the car. SEPTA pulled that car out of service and immediately launched an inspection of the other 219 M4 rail cars that run on the L. SEPTA engineers think the fissures were caused by cracks in motor vents welded to the car body bolsters, so they sideline any car with a cracked vent.
As of this morning, the inspections have yielded 58 cars with vent cracks and two with car body bolster cracks.
Without those cars, SEPTA had just 108 running on the L, instead of a full complement of 144. That means fewer trains during rush hours. This morning, trains ran every 6 minutes instead of every four. Despite the lack of trains, the morning commute wasn't too bad for most riders, says Knuppel.
I'm not saying it wasn't crowded, but we did not see crowding conditions that created a lot of problems.
SEPTA set aside 60 buses to help with overcrowding on the L, but ended up running just 8. Knuppel is not able to say how long repairs would take and is asking riders to remain patient. I'm Jim Saxa, WHYY News.
There's a rare area of bipartisan accord across the country regarding President Donald Trump's call to invest in infrastructure. The University of Pennsylvania's Institute for Urban Research asked 16 of its fellows to weigh in on what the United States should do toward that end. Let's hear from one of them, Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics. Mark, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you, Dave.
Mark, is it safe to say the overall goal of investing in infrastructure is to help jumpstart or bolster the economy?
Yeah, both near-term because it will create jobs, a lot of construction jobs for that are middle-paying jobs, good jobs, and also longer run because the infrastructure is key to the competitiveness of our economy and helps long-term growth. So it's good both for the near-term and the long run.
So when most people, I suspect, think infrastructure, they're thinking new roads, highways, bridges, airports, tunnels, railways. Though your take on this offers, in addition, affordable housing.
Yeah, and those are all good things, and we certainly need them. But yeah, I focused on affordable housing. There is a shortage of affordable housing across the country. Vacancy rates are very low and falling because of the lack of construction. So lots of lower and lower middle-income households are having a really difficult time finding affordable rental housing, and I think that's a place where the administration, Congress, should focus in their efforts to promote more infrastructure.
Something analogous to the mortgage deduction for homeowners are you proposing for rentals?
Well, not a bad thing, yeah. It's more, in a sense, it's a low-income housing tax credit that's already in place, used quite a bit by banks and developers. In fact, most of the affordable rental housing constructed in the United States is financed with help from the low-income housing tax credit. And that's one way of doing it. We could expand that, make that a bigger program, and thus increase the supply of affordable units to those households. So that'd be one way of doing it.
What
yes.
are some alternate ways to achieve the same end?
Well, there's all other forms of tax credits, tax subsidies, new market tax credits. That's a very popular program that I think could be used more effectively. There's a lot of state programs. Also, we could expand the support rent payments by low-income households through Section 8 and other subsidies to low-income households to help them be able to afford the rents that they have to pay. So there's a range of ways of doing it. The interesting thing about the low-income housing tax credit, though, is that's something that Mr. Trump knows quite a bit about. He used that as a developer, and it's very, very popular in both Republican and Democratic circles. So I think that that has political viability as well as economic viability.
Your remedy in terms of being not what is expected by many when one considers infrastructure, again, physical structures, is echoed by a couple of your cohort at the Institute. Timothy Bartik refers to infrastructure and distressed areas. And Peter Hendy Brown writes on invest in the public realm, all variations of the same theme.
Yeah, you know, I think the key here is that we have real pockets of distress in inner cities and rural areas. You know, for many of us, the economy is doing fine and we live in a home, our house price is rising, things are fine, they're okay. But there are folks that are struggling, and obviously that was one of the reasons why the election turned out the way it did. So I think it is important that we put together policies that are focused on trying to help those distressed communities, those distressed households.
Though, isn't there a danger that, for example, changing trade policy and loosening regulations might, at least in the long term, worsen the situation for those Americans who perhaps cast their ballot for Donald Trump?
For sure. I mean, there's a lot of moving parts here, infrastructure only being one very small part of it. I mean, the debate is on trade policy, on immigration, on tax reform, both corporate and individual tax reform, on regulation, financial regulation, Obamacare, healthcare. So a lot of moving parts to nail down over the next few years, I suspect.
Bob Dylan's lyric over a half a century ago is prescient. The times, they are a-changing.
They are a-changing. You know, we voted for change, and we're going to get it.
Mark, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you, Dave.
Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics, and you can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Finding steady work after prison is a big challenge and a big priority. The money is important, but the structure that a job provides is also critical. A new Philadelphia nonprofit offers both to those fresh out of jail, and it all starts with your trash, as WHYY's Aaron Mozell explains.
I pretty much take them apart pretty fast.
Inside a jam-packed warehouse, Gerald is wearing a hard hat and safety goggles. He's digging through the guts of an old Dell computer tower for scrap.
And these are our rams. The rams, they have gold on them as well. And this is called a processor. These actually are gold as well.
Gerald is floor supervisor at Par Recycle Works, a year-old nonprofit in the city's Germantown section that takes outdated electronics from individuals, churches, schools, wherever really, and turns them into temporary jobs for ex-offenders, typically two or three at a time. It's a pretty simple business model. RecycleWorks frees the valuable parts from the donated tech and trucks them to a scrapyard. Even plastics are turned into cash. The profits, up to $1,500 a week, cover hourly wages and rent. Gerald, who most recently spent time in federal prison on drug charges, says it's also a very sustainable operation. We're withholding Gerald's last name so we don't undermine any efforts to have his records sealed or expunged.
Pretty much there's an in supply of it. We just have to tap into it because we haven't tapped into even one-third of the city's recyclable stuff.
There's also an endless supply of men and women for RecycleWorks to hire. It's estimated that up to 1 in 3 Philadelphia residents have a criminal record. At $10 an hour, 3 days a week, it's not the kind of gig that'll make paying for life much easier. But participants like Malik say the value of a place like RecycleWorks extends far beyond a paycheck.
I think that it gives a guy a sense of self, and it prepares him for a skill set going back out into the workforce, which is to say he gets up every morning on time, he shows up to work, he works hard, he feels fulfilled.
operations manager and fellow ex-offender Maurice says the nonprofit also provides its employees with a much-needed support system. He says coming home from prison is often harder than being behind bars, where there are no real-life responsibilities and far less temptation. Having someone to talk to, someone who knows what you're going through, helps.
A lot of the guys say, just tell me something. And I, you know, one of the things I tell them, it's going to be okay. Or they'll say, hey, listen, I'm thinking about doing X. Listen, that's not what you want to do. Do you want to go back to jail? And sometimes they need that wake-up call.
Board member Laura Ford likens RecycleWorks to a nest, a place that nurtures and teaches its employees they're valuable despite their criminal pasts.
Many people think that people are getting out of prison are just sort of to be discarded just as these electronics are to be discarded or junked, you know. And there's all kinds of valuable things inside of a computer, gold and copper and all kinds of precious metals. And there's all kinds of precious things inside of these men.
Employees at RecycleWorks typically stay on between 6 and 9 months, though there's no hard cutoff. The hope is that the company can be that stepping stone for securing permanent employment, for staying on the straight path. On a recent wind-whipped afternoon, Maurice and Malik rumble into SD Richmond Sons, an expansive scrapyard in Port Richmond, not far from I-95. They come here once a week to cash in on other people's junk and to see a friend.
Hop up here. Let me show you what I got so you can tell me if you take it or not.
Brandon was one of RecycleWorks' first employees. After serving time for aggravated assault, the soon-to-be father now works full-time for Richmond's. The owner saw his work ethic and brought him on board.
It feels much better to do things legally, not worrying about having to look behind my back or thinking I'm going to get caught for this. Now I can just wake up and go to work and cash my check and feel good about it.
And his future. Brandon says he'd like to open his own scrapyard one day. So far, other people's trash has been his ticket to a better life. I'm Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
Let's take a break from all the weighty news of late. Why don't we head out to the links with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, I have my driver ready. Where are we going?
Well, we're going to the most distant fairway in the solar system for golfers anyway. It was 46 years ago today that astronaut Alan Bean pulled out a 6-iron from his toolkit there on the moon and 2 golf balls in an attempt to make the longest golf drive ever known.
How long?
It actually turned out to be a little over a mile, although, as he exclaimed once he finally hit the ball some distance, he said, miles and miles and miles. But that's how it looked to him.
Did he hit it off a tee or just right off of the lunar dust?
You know, there was a big difficulty about this. Number one, he was using a converted lunar science tool, a geology tool that had been adapted to take the head of the 6-iron, number one. Number two, the spacesuit was kind of stiff, so he couldn't actually use 2 arms to, you know, grip the quote-unquote club and swing to hit the ball. And then the last problem was, because the suit was so stiff, it made it very difficult for him to bend over to, like, place the ball on a tee. So what he did was he pulled 2 golf balls out of a pocket, dropped one right on the ground in front of him, maneuvered it around a little bit, and then tried to hit the ball. He took 2 swings that didn't work out, and then the third swing, off that ball went. And he had 1 more ball that he dropped and launched out into the lunar, a lunar fairway sphere.
Alas, low-gravity golf hasn't caught on yet. If we ever do make it to Mars, is the gravity similar there as it is on the moon?
No, it's actually a little bit more on Mars. The gravity on the moon is 1/6 that of Earth, and on Mars it's 1/3 that of Earth.
As you mentioned Mars, let's talk about not fully formed planets and the search to find them.
This has always been a challenge. Distance has been a major factor. The second factor is that if you're looking for planets orbiting stars, the brightness of the star way overpowers any telescope detection system like a camera, either photographic with film or even some sort of electronic camera. The light from the star is just too bright. The planets are just too close. Obviously, over a very long distance, they'll appear, you know, right on top of the star, no matter what their distance is.
So you resort to inferential evidence.
Well, that's true. And we've done some inferential work in the past using either radio instruments to detect the presence of an object, But now our capability is developing to be able to image objects forming right around new stars using what was really a technology that has been known for some time for use here on Earth. It's called a coronagraph, and a coronagraph is simply a device that places a disk in front of the sun so that we can observe the sun's atmosphere. Otherwise, it would affect our eyes.
Then where does the protoplanet come into play?
New technologies have been developed recently, one of them called the vortex coronagraph. It's a disk a half inch wide and a tenth of an inch thick. It's incredibly thin, but this device, placed inside an infrared detector being used at the Keck telescopes in Mauna Kea, Hawaii, have enabled astronomers to be able to redirect the light from the star to make these dust rings appear. And in the dust rings, astronomers are being now able to see clumps of material about the size of Jupiter that are orbiting these stars.
We've gotten ahead of ourselves. What is a protoplanet?
Yes, we have stepped a little bit far out, and a protoplanet is an object that is just beginning to form around very young stars.
So clearly, there are no protoplanets to be found in our mature solar system.
No, all the planets in our solar system are formed. They're all here, although we find a great variety of planets and moons here that chases us down another rabbit hole in a sense, because as we look around the galaxy, no doubt we'll find many, many more examples.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight.
Space is the place. Space is the place.
That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.
Space is the place, yeah. Space is the place.